Hello, everyone. I think we'll get started. My name is Sabelle Knowles, and I'm the events coordinator for the Poetry Center. And welcome to today's event, which is our Next Word in Poetry panel discussion for 2010. Next Word in Poetry is an event that we do every year. It's in its eighth year. For Next Word, we invite three poets who we feel to be among the most exciting, innovative, and new, and invite them to do a reading and then also to come back the next day for a public conversation about their work. So today, or this year, we have Akila Oliver, Philip Jenks, Brandon Shimoda, who have come from Brooklyn, Chicago, and Seattle, respectively. They gave a fantastic reading last night. You are probably mostly all here. And today, they're going to talk about their work and how they come to it. And our moderator is going to be our very own Chris Nelson, graduate student in poetry here at the U of A. Okay, so thank you all for participating. And Chris, oh, before I give this to Chris, I'm going to say you're probably wondering why we're using mics on this quiet Friday afternoon. We don't need this technology to hear each other, but we're recording this panel for our archive, and the only thing that will end up on the recording is what goes through the mics. So that's why we're using the mics. If you have questions, try and speak into the mic, and I'll help you remember, and that goes for you guys too.
Thank you, Sabelle. So I have some questions that I've written. Sabelle has also written some topics that I have here, but we'd like it to be a somewhat informal dialogue, so if at any point you want to ask us to elaborate or go into a different topic, then just raise your hand and we'll pass you the mic. So I thought we could start with talking about the dictions that you use in your works, because this is a commonality, I think, in your works, is that you all sometimes use unusual dictions. In Brandon's The Alps, for example, we have occasionally an antiquated diction and antiquated spellings. And in Akila's A Toast in the House of Friends, something that we could maybe call chant, a chant sort of diction and repetition. And in Philip's work, what has sometimes been called an Appalachian dialect. So can you talk about the functions of these unusual dictions in your work and what your interests are in them?
I guess this is... first, I want to thank everyone for being here in the Poetry Center, and Sabelle and Chris and Akila and Brandon. All right. Well, I had to say it, you know, it's true. It's real. I'm not lying. So in terms of Appalachian dialect, as we say it, that's how we say it there, as Appalachian. And that's you know, neither here nor there. But, for one, I grew up in it. So, in a sense, it's not something I use, you know, it's not a tool, but then again, it is. That would be a cop-out. I could just say that and then walk away and say, it's not a tool, and, you know, I don't use it, it's just there. But it really is there in my head. If I go home to West Virginia for any period of time or talk to my sister on the phone for more than an hour, that's the voice I speak in. And I was trained, as were the rest of us, to not speak in that incorrect language. That is not correct, proper English. In fact, my job now as a grammarian, as Alyssa Wolf would term it, in composition, is to correct that all the time. Much to my dismay, it's one of my jobs. But I hope that the poems function to demarcate the absolute legitimacy of any diction. That there is no one right way to speak. There is no, the amplitudes and possibilities of language are what make one of the things that make poetry so great, and that make people so great. And on that part about it not being a tool, it also functions in rhyme. So sounds different than poor. And also in meter. I done did this, might add something in there. There's all kinds of, quote, incorrect usages that come out. And also terms that I don't hear other places, like glister. I don't hear that outside of where I grew up, but the water just glisters, you know, as one guy put it. Anyways, what a great word. That's my first effort.
That was one of the questions that was proposed to us before coming out, and I guess to a certain extent I have to confess some naivete in terms of what I'm actually doing. So I looked back through the book that was being referenced to actually find some of those antiquated words, and I think in the process of looking at these poems so often, I don't know what's antiquated and not, what's not anymore. I look at it all as this, I guess that continuum sort of collapses, or that, again, that history sort of collapses, and it all becomes really strange, or it all becomes really familiar, which is also fairly strange. So I did find stuff in the book that was really weird. Actually, I didn't remember how it came to be. Words that I actually didn't remember generating or encountering at all, but somehow they made their way into the final thing. And to kind of take a little bit of what Philip was saying, that everything is available, I guess to a certain extent I don't necessarily see the differences between types of words or types of diction, because I guess to frame something as antiquated, that really is the case in relation to something that's contemporary. But if you kind of drop both of those divisions out, then it's just a bunch of really fabulous weirdness, I think, that's available to us. So I don't know if that's also, or I don't know if that's, I think a variety of my answers might be borderline cop-out, but.
Well, thanks for opening up. I think that's a really great question to start with. I was thinking about four different ways of thinking about diction and the way maybe that I'm approaching it. In one of the sections of A Toast in the House of Friends, the Arriving Guard of Angels section, that is a sounding section and also kind of an homage section. So there are these repeating phrases, who dat, who dem come. And so it was really purposeful to spell who's that as D-A-T. That as D-A-T, and them as D-E-M. And I was really trying to evoke one kind of code switching into African-American speech. And the sound for me was really important. It was more important to say them than them, because I was also kind of thinking in the strange kind of maybe non-linear way of some connection with retrieval of resistance or histories of resistance and reclaiming, I guess, that kind of coded vernacular, I guess, in that way for me kind of also invoked that, and it felt kind of powerful. Sometimes when I read it as who dat, and sometimes I read it as who is that, just depending on, I guess, both the sound that I want to evoke, and also kind of the message exchange with the audience. And then I was thinking, too, of Harriet Mullins, is a pretty amazing poet. She has a book called Sleeping with the Dictionary, which is such a strange, beautiful title. I like it quite a bit. And in some parts of the book, I had passed this manuscript by a friend of mine, another writer, and, you know, and she's a great editor and very impatient and will just, you know, mark things and scribble and, you know, everything's in red. And she said, why don't you find some words that do something for some specific words that I had. Like I had this adjective about, I think it was the driving rain. And she said, why don't you find a word that does something? And I was like, okay, I guess driving is not doing anything for the rain. And another, I guess she's really... a fiction writer or prose writer, Banu Kapil. Banu also likes to talk about bibliomancy, and she will say, well, if you're looking for a word, I'm not doing a very good Banu imitation, but I'm trying, then just think about what you want to get, and then put your hand on the book of the dictionary and open it. And I got the word gurning. From that kind of process. And then it became the gurning rain, meaning something about sheets. And, you know, it became a very, and it was what I wanted. And I was like, that's interesting. Thanks, Banu. Not sure of how often I can get away with that. But I really appreciated doing that gesture. And then the other thing I was thinking about how diction, and I hope I'm not leading us into the political question too soon, also reflects, I guess, a kind of political intent. I was just thinking, spent a little time in Berlin this summer, and there's lots of American expats in Berlin right now. And every once in a while, people, like several times a day, would say, have you heard from anyone in America? As if we haven't all been on Facebook and, you know, email. And it's like, or, but everyone would never say, you know, Chicago, the United States, or Texas. Everyone, I would always say, America. And it became this intentional nostalgia, this intentional connection with this land base. And, you know, we never corrected each other, like, you mean North America? I mean, you know, South, like what? So it was also interesting how that kind of diction became connected to a kind of nostalgic claim over a place. And in the United States, I don't think we would ever really, you know, use that term in quite the same way. Like, you know, have you heard from Sue in Chicago, in America? So it's really interesting to me how words and also sound and how they connect to different histories and memories as well. So.
Great, thank you. No, I'm glad you brought up the political poetry topic right now, because I was wondering how we would segue into that. It's such a big thing to take on. But I would like us to address that topic, the topic of political poetry. And there's a few ways we could go about that, but maybe the easiest way would be to just ask if you consider your poetry or some aspect of your poetry political, and how or why.
Yes. Absolutely. I'd like to... I think sometimes I was looking back and thinking about it. There are historical accounts of the marginalized, including going back to the Appalachian component, but not only, in terms of gender, in terms of war, genocide. The hypothetical antipodes or antipodes, depending on how you want to say that, poems in On the Cave You Live In are all about, a different account of how the 60s felt in Appalachia when the war on poverty happened and situations were so-called improved. A lot of people said, we've had enough of your help, because help was often tied to internal colonization. I think of the horror of imperialism I end up writing about it, both internal and external. I don't think it extends only beyond national borders I think it also goes inside them and inside each consciousness. And that's what I tried to do with the Hydra series of poems that I wrote. So I think, you know, we could debate definitions of the political, right? So I don't know if I've answered. I haven't answered the whole question. I don't know. But there's like part one or part two.
Okay, well,
should we go
maybe
now?
We can hear. Yeah, Annie has a question. Annie, let me give you the mic, okay?
So we were talking about how class last night relates to the political poem. And, you know, there's this question about, is that really addressed or not?
Mm-hmm.
So you could probably go in at that angle. But it also brought up the interesting idea that if you don't read in the cadence of the dialect that you're adopting, when you perform, what does that mean? What does that mean about class? And what is it, you know, how does that reveal your stance? So you could talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. One could be reading in the cadence, either cadence. It depends on, it might be depending on who the audience is and how I think I might strike them or communicate with them, or how I might be feeling. I might be feeling outside myself, outside that part that grew up, wherever it grew up, in which case I'm alienated from myself, which is a political process. In terms of class, I think these are great questions. I don't think that I've found, maybe someone else could help me, I've found poems that confront the institutional power relations of academia that affect the world and affect how we consider, what we consider political poetry. Class, labor relations within academia don't seem to occupy a large component of academic poetry. It's as, maybe people are afraid. Everyone's up, you know, look at the economic status of where we're at. Everyone's looking over their shoulders. And the people who aren't within academia often are marginalized or not listened to. They're in another category, another class altogether. And so I'm hoping that what I can do next is listen to the history of how other laborers and writers, which we are, organized and wrote on class and power. And that's only going to happen by listening and talking to others. So, I don't know. I think I've said enough.
I think it's... I've been thinking a lot about this, and my thoughts are totally confused, and they only become more confused the more I think about it. But one thing is definitely this idea of historical accounts of the marginalized and giving voice to various communities and sub-communities and sub-sub-communities that are so because of some overriding structure that makes that the case. And I really struggle to understand whether or not giving voice or allowing some communities to reflect out into the world is political, or if the problem is that it still kind of aligns itself somehow in some obverse way in within the political system itself, and that poetry is meant to be some other subterranean thing that functions so far outside that system that it I don't know, creates another constellation altogether. Because I think that for me, I'm really struggling again with this idea of political and politics, which I don't even really know what that means. I mean, I don't know what it means now. I don't know what it was originally intended to mean. I don't know what politics was originally intended to do. I do feel like I know it was intended to do something, which I think is part of the problem. I think that anything that has a goal or that supposes something or idealizes something and then sets up some sort of apparatus that satisfies that goal or that supposition is not poetry, or it has no relation to it. Because for me, anyway, poetry is something that has really no goal, I suppose. It has, and I don't know what its relationship is to desire either. I think that poetry is some other substance or that accretes into a community that functions outside of those sorts of ideas. So I don't know. I think we can argue, you know, infinitely about the idea of political poetry. I wonder what something like social poetry would mean, or what something like, to give just an example, and then I'll pass the microphone, is in my writing, I guess the thing that could be most easily categorized as political poetry, though not necessarily by me, would be the poems that address certain historical events. The bombing of Japan during World War II, and trying to imagine, based on research and based on interviews and talking with relatives and whatnot, trying to imagine or somehow rewrite that or somehow inhabit that space. And I don't think that's, or at least I don't know if that's political, if that undertaking is political, because I think that what I'm really interested in is the people. I'm interested in the environment and those communities, and I'm not interested in the governing apparatus that caused that situation to have happened, to come into being, because then I feel like I'm giving too much credence to that apparatus and not enough to the people who are kind of suffering underneath that. So I don't know what that is. I really don't know what that might be, but something I continue to think and kind of sweat through.
Yeah, I think that that's a really good point that you made, Brandon, that it's a thinking through process rather than, for me, political poetry as a conclusion or a definition. So I'm going to kind of skip that because I'm not sure what the definition of political poetry is, but I think that poems can act politically or that poems can act in various ways. So I think for me what's key about that is act, is that politics to be political is to act. So in that sense, we're all political all the time, and poems act, so they are also political. But I was thinking about Haiti, actually, and the situation that's, before the world now, and it's clearly a human situation, and it's clearly a political situation. Like part of the solution for Haiti right now is political, and that's why it's not going to be offered to them right now, because those politics are not in favor. Even with our present administration, I love Obama, but the administration is not about progressive politics in the U.S.'s relationship to the Caribbean or to places like Haiti or places like Cuba or other nation states right now that have a long relationship with the United States in which they're disempowered and have a relationship of distress. And so that's a political situation. And I was thinking, what do we do as poets? And it's the same that we do as people. I couldn't think of what I do as a poet that I would not do as a person. That why would the two be separated? Why would I ask poets to somehow be the kind of harbingers of some kind of sublime or progressive message that I can't be as an individual? It's almost that division between politics and poetry for me. It doesn't quite work. It's a little artificial. But I was thinking, too, that for me, part of what it means to be conscious of a politic when I'm writing is to be conscious of form and what I'm doing outside of traditional form and why I'm so often breaking form, or I'm playing with disjuncture and I'm playing with fracturing and I'm playing with breaking both in terms of meaning and in terms of subject. And for me, that's the world right now, that I can go from Haiti on television to something radically different and something else and something else, and they're all compatible, and they're all contained within a technological discourse. I mean, I can access any, pretty much any discourse at any given time and simultaneously. So there's this there's this thing with even simple technologies like Facebook that we use. There are these communication systems that have collapsed ideological borders. To me, that's very exciting, so that we don't have to keep repeating the old politics that don't work. We don't have to be, oh, I'm the radical outside of the system and I'm the oppressed. I don't find that those terms to be useful at all anymore. When we're in this age of itinerancy and things are moving and things are shifting, and I don't have to speak for Haitians, and I know what you meant by giving the marginalized a voice, but I don't have to give them their voice. They already have it, and they have access in Haiti as well to technology. And so we're getting like snippets coming across, poetry, poets are making work coming through, like the Buffalo Litserv, and posting it. People are just instantly posting things. People are videotaping, even with the limited technology that's available there, and things are being, you know, they're just crossing these ideological and physical borders, and to me that's a form of making meaning and engaging in the world where we are now. So I don't have to kind of reconstitute myself in relationship to terms that don't work for me anymore, i.e. The oppressed and the oppressor, or the marginalized and who. I mean, who is not marginalized from what? Or that centers, or that there is a center rather than there are various centers that are always circulating and dancing around each other, and that power is an exchange constantly. So I'm not trying to minimize, like, the real poverty in Haiti right now, or, you know, even as a working class poet, intellectual, the privileges that I have in the United States. I mean, those are like real differences, but at the same time, there's also they're not real differences, that all that becomes relative after a while. So for me, form becomes really important, and then if for me the world is this place of itinerancy, there's all this movement, borders are shifting, things are constantly being rearranged, and there's all these ways to communicate that almost instantly, and then they shift again, and then something else is made. Form for me becomes a way of being a part of that. And if that's, and to me, that's political. You know, those are the politics of my time, and I'm just trying to be in it.
Great. Thank you for those thoughtful responses. I know there's a lot of evocative ideas there to think about. Before we move on to a different topic, are there any follow-up or related questions to that? Yeah. Any?
Well, I find myself agreeing with everyone, but then a question comes to mind, which is, are we just so privileged that we're able to reject, you know, this someone's desire to call and collect political poetry? You know, are we so privileged that we're able to say, you know, that doesn't exist? Is that going on? I mean, well, I don't know, but that's my question is it we don't know because, you know, we don't have to become revolutionaries in our lives? Are we so cushioned or protected as Americans, or in our particular, you know, I'm saying our because, like I said, I agree, but that question comes to mind. Because I think that there is this strong desire to collect that into a movement. But I also have that same resistance. So if anybody has any ideas.
Well, I'm not sure. I think that's a great question, Annie, that you can't just erase privilege and maybe a certain resistance to claiming a political space, especially here in this country, where it's so easy to disclaim any kind of engaged political space. But I for me, the question is difficult because I don't know what we haven't come up with a definition of what political poetry is. I think that poems can function politically and that I can function as a political poet. I can go and read my poems at a fundraiser for something specific that is a politic or a cause that I support, and then I'm being consciously a political poet, and what I might choose to read at that particular gathering might be different from what I read last night because I want to incite a different kind of relationship with the subject or with the audience. So for me, it's I'm not sure if there's a body of poetry that I can say, this is political poetry, and that's not political poetry. We did a class visit yesterday, and we talked about slam poetry. And one of the things that I thought about afterwards that is that what I didn't mention is that I was talking about how, one, that's not my genre, and but I do respect it, and that much of slam poetry, the topics are political. The topics are contemporary, they're political, they're immediate, and is that then a form of political poetry? But how is it political if it stays within the arena of the club where it's being performed? And so it's performed for a reception audience of other political poets and is not part of the discourse of the world. One of my favorite poets who I think is a political poet is Fanny Howe. And there's not a lot about Fanny Howe's work on the surface that you necessarily say, this is political poetry. But when I look at a book like The Wedding Dress, which is a book of essays, and especially an essay that I love and I use a lot called Bewilderment, where she's taking this ideal of bewilderment from Sufism, and she's thinking about bewilderment as this quest and this leading you into the question. And then she goes out of that, and she said, at some point in that essay, she talks about, I'm writing this because if someone who has no voice could have written this, they would have. And then she goes right back into these meditations on, you know, just this image of the forest, and the forest is being this place that where not only is something is the possibility of being lost, but there's the possibility of rediscovery. To me, these are the politics that are at play in my life right now. And privilege is relative. You know, in one place I'm privileged, in another place I'm not. In one place I have some semblance of power, in another place or position in my daily life I don't. And I'm always conscious of that exchange. So for me, if the work is conscious of also those exchanges, to me it gets really kind of, I'm not trying to evade the question, but I don't think that there is necessarily a political poetry that functions outside of what any other poetry does for me, that it's how the poetry is used and who it's addressed to at any given time. But I think that there are politics in something like Fanny Howe's Bewilderment, or throughout the other essays of The Wedding Dress, where the intersections are between meditations on the spiritual, meditations on history. Interestingly enough, she does a lot of meditation on class and race without renaming it in the same paradigm that keeps us in the false, to me, the false mythologies of class and race.
Oh. I agree. Yeah. No, I was just saying I agree.
You have to get passionate about politics.
I am passionate about politics.
I know you're,
Philip. Yeah, and, you know, to me, one of the things I really liked about, or called, I made me think when you were talking, is Patricia Hill Collins' work that in that Black Feminist Thought, there's that part where she talks about not the either or, but the both and, both privileged and oppressed, and that we're always in that matrix of domination, and that there's always a power relationship there, and where I walk in one situation, I'm, you know, completely privileged, or not completely, but relatively privileged, and in another context, totally not. One thought I have about, I mean, another perspective, yeah, defining political poetry, that could take a lifetime. But another thought I have is, even, I mean, what if a poem or any set of words acts by not ever addressing anything? Let's say somebody never addresses any of these issues whatsoever. consciously or unconsciously? Is that not a politics? Is that not also a politics? Is there a reactionary poetry? Is that not political poetry? Is there language that isn't political? Is there a way of speaking that does not demarcate meaning and as such hegemony? Somebody can go and give, marvelous, great mainstream poets who I adore, adore their work. But is there not also a politics there? Not just what one makes an issue, but when one makes a non-issue by not speaking it. I don't know what the answer is. It's easier to ask a rhetorical question than to provide the answer. So with that.
I can say something. I love definitions. I'm not afraid of them. when I think of political poetry, good political poetry, I think of poems, which I feel like you all write, where you can see people or the speaker, whatever, yourselves, both as prisoners of history and as like human consciousness or human processors. And what I like about all your poems is that I feel like you go back and forth between that. So there's the wedding, but then there's the bomb, and that they are connected. There's a personal story of loss, but then there's also racial politics. And there's just, there's poverty, but there's also like this kind of almost religious consciousness. So I don't know, that's what I like in your work, and that's why I would call you political poets, is that you can see us as prisoners of history in with like a lot of compassion.
That was kind of intense. Should we do a different topic now? So you've all used photographs or artwork in conjunction to some of your poems. In Brandon's The Alps, art and empty frames, maybe where pictures might go or might have been. I'm curious if you can talk about why you bring visual images into some of your poems.
I'll start by saying that this book, The Alps, actually started out as only images. It was, for people who haven't actually seen the book, in the middle there's this 30 or so page section that has these blank squares followed by these really short lyric poems. And the blank squares are 3 inch by 3 inch, and they represent images that actually existed. There were about 300 of them, and I was gathering images of the Alps and life in the Alps from old issues of National Geographic and books and photographs from my family, and just cutting them into three inch by three inch squares. And that was going to be the Alps. I had originally planned it as an installation that was just going to be mounted on a wall and in a straight line and curve around the ceiling. The fact that it's a book, I think, is to a certain extent proof of the failure of that visual idea. A lot of the work I used to do was visual, and growing up and then in undergraduate school and then after undergraduate school, I was primarily doing visual work, and slowly I was adding text to that, and ultimately the text took over. Again, part of that was because I wasn't actually a very good artist, or at least I didn't feel like I was. So the text was emerging from that failure. Became increasingly interested in what the text was doing, and then the poems broke out of that, and they started to become actual poems that I could call poems. This project is a way to sort of work that into it. And obviously there's There's a few photographs that still remain throughout the book. The blank squares were one, a way to still sort of include that. This project in particular was, I invited 20 or so people to respond to 20 or so images, I guess. And literally, I gave them these images that everyone except for one person was a poet. And I asked them to literally tell me what they saw. So if it was a picture of a girl running down a slope of ice, they would write that in whatever words they wanted to use. So I had maybe 50 pages of responses that I whittled down into these really small poems. So all the words in that section were written by these other people. And it was sort of a way... I was sort of being dictatorial in that I took their words and just kind of rang whatever life I wanted out of them. But it was also a way to invite this community of people that I really admired to take part in the book by way of these images, that we were all communally looking at these things together and thinking about what it was that we were looking at, and that all of that energy would somehow make its way into the pages of this thing. The visual is always very important to me, whether or not that manifests in the writing or in the format of the poems themselves. It's something I'm always thinking about. So.
Can I ask a question? Do you mean rang, R-A-N-G, or W-R-A-N-G?
The images that I have in the house, A Toast in the House of Friends, are graffiti pictures that... are documentations my son took of his graffiti work, which is, I didn't know it at the time because I wasn't really that aware of the whole graph culture. Is really very common is that writers will document their art and they will, you know, put it online and or just have all these photographs or scrapbooks because by nature it's public art and it's illegal, so it's going to be erased sooner or later, that it has a short kind of physical life. So I came across all these photographs he had after he died, and I was started to think about graffiti as elegiac in a way that so that the photographs and the book for me became a conversation with this idea about the public elegy, and that graffiti, both by I guess its messiness and because it's insurgent and it's illegal, that it really represents these bodies, you know, that are really political bodies, these bodies that are usurping political space and are, you know, so, you know, it's really controversial. But then I was thinking about the unintelligibility of it too, you know, that I had to learn how to read different scrawls, not scrawls, different fonts, I guess, and styles, etc. They're also individualized. And so then I begin to just think about public naming. They're also, and basically graffiti is someone's name, that it's, they're all somebody's name or, you know, their tag. And that's exactly what it is, whether it's a small scrawl or it's a huge kind of, you know, multicolored, almost mural-like thing. So I was just thinking, wow, that's really interesting that there's this temporal nature that it's going to disappear. And then it also moves. And I was thinking, well, why do people paint trains? Because, well, that's how you move your art, you know, because the trains will move right along with the graffiti on it. So that particular section is pretty contained. I haven't done a lot of collaboration with visual images, but I'd like to do more.
I've been asked questions about visual nature of my work, and at first I was eager to deny that there was any. And it's kind of ridiculous. My first painting will be The Accuser. It's in the title. And my sister did the artwork. But quite aside from that, the How Many of You Are You volume is, that chapbook is, to me, I did, I took the photographs in West Virginia, in Morgantown, and actually I did that for a political science project that I was doing as just attendant work, kind of in the vein, or not that I am equal to it, but Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. in an attempt to kind of update that, think about that. And then I put those photographs aside and carried on. And then a poetry project came out of that. I don't think of the visual as, you know, like separate from any other material, sensory material or any material in materiality of the world. So I don't know if I think of language as not being adequate to the task, though perhaps it can never apprehend the world fully. Nothing, you know, can in that sense. But you know, it's just one more amazing way of conversing with the world. In this case, it was a weird project because they weren't photos that someone else took. So it was me looking at photos that I had taken at another point in time. So it was also me looking at my own perspective and like, yes, which was kind of a freak out. It was like a mirror of a mirror of them, you know? I don't know where that's going really, but, that's one way in which, the visual works there.
Great. Thank you for those answers. Do you have any interests or activities outside of poetry that you feel are essential to your poetry or augment it in an important way? Like, Philip, I know you're in a musical band, The Howling Hex.
Yes. No, absolutely. I mean, the music informed, well, the poetry started my involvement with the band, but now the music has always informed. Sound is the most, I mean, if I'm going to give anything primary, of all the sensory apparatuses, sound has always been, to me, the most amazing. And music, there's so much going on to just listen sometimes, or to make it. I don't know if there's meditation's another one. I would say, for me, which is just getting clear on things, which I don't know if I ever do, but that's it for me.
The idea of music, this is not about me, but the idea of music, I've been really excited about this musicologist, James Curry. There's actually a local artist who puts together this online magazine space, collaborative space called Trick House. And if you don't know it, it's fantastic, trickhouse.org. Yeah, the most recent issue has this interview with this musicologist, James Curry, who I've never heard of before, and I don't know very much about the theory of music. But, Philip, it's something you should definitely check out. He talks about in very rich, elaborate, and very complex language, he talks about our relationship to music. And I sort of read it also as our relationship to poetry, which is something totally different, but there are some resonances there. He wrote this very long essay called Music After All, and then he talks a little bit about how our relationship to music actually takes us away from the human, how it brings us into this actually really wonderful generative realm of impersonality, in which we can function in a way that's free from being human. And that's actually a really awful paraphrase of what he's actually saying, but it's something that I started to think of in relation to poetry, because I'm constantly wondering why I'm writing, and when I read and something hits me in a certain way, and that you know, bolt of energy courses through me, what is that? I don't know what that is. And is that me being human? Is that connecting, again, in a political way or a social way, or what's happening there? I recommend reading that interview as a starting place.
ditto about music. It's very important to me. Other than that, I just basically write and read. I enjoy bowling and Project Runway and television, unfortunately, has become something I enjoy quite a bit lately, and tennis. So that's those are my interests.
Both, can I speak for us in this circumstance? Brandon and I have also agreed that The Hills is an important influence on our poetics, the television show. Yeah. Much based, my theory is because there's great spaces of silence, or at least spaciness.
Well, we have time for a couple of more questions. Are there any from the audience that... anything you'd like to talk about? Do the poets have questions for each other?
Philip, you mentioned mainstream poets that you admire. Who might some of those be? Mainstream poets, who are some of those you admire?
Living or dead?
Either way.
Oh, okay. Oh, good. That makes it much easier. Well, most anything in the Norton Anthology is... No, I'll narrow it down. That's not fair. That's not fair. I've caught some heat from the experimental, some of them. You know, poets have to fight about something, right? For liking Robert Lowell, you know, it's really getting dangerous out there. You know, I like Robert Lowell. I'm sorry. I think that he's tremendously skilled, and yet his notebooks. There's a sense of the naturalness of a voice, but at the same time, is tremendously skilled. It's just practice. And there's something horrifying about his work. I'm not talking about his life. And yeah, so that's one. Emily Dickinson, I like her. Every time I go to her poems, there's something else there. I don't know if she's mainstream, though, even though she is canonized. Those are a couple. I could keep going. George Meredith. George Meredith is great. Modern Love. I love that. I love Modern Love. Anyways, all right, I'll stop.
I could keep going.
I'm wondering, both in the creation of work and... how you relate to your work after it's an existent poem or collection of poems. How, I'm trying to think how I can phrase this. I'm interested in that kind of the double life of a poem, how it exists both on the page in a concrete form and how it exists in a performance space, you know, during a reading. And I'm trying to narrow down my question. I guess if you could speak to that somehow, what your relationship is to your work as it exists on the page and also as it exists in as you're reading, you know, in that performance aspect of it.
I guess that's a big question that I'm not totally sure about, but
it's pretty broad,
yeah, but good. No, I mean, but very good. A lot of the stuff I write is not, I have no intention of it ever being read out loud. And in fact, I read something in the class yesterday that I had never read aloud. And I hadn't even thought about whether or not it was meant to be read aloud. It was something that it on the page anyway, it's visually oriented. You can read it. It's composed of language. But
I actually struggle with the idea of readings. I mean, oddly, I think that I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do and what the writing is supposed to do. Sometimes I feel like I should just kind of move aside and let it sort of live its life and succeed and fail on its own terms while I do something else in another room. Sometimes I feel like I need to sort of coach it, or I need to eat it and expel it in front of a bunch of people, and then it becomes the audience's problem. I don't really know, but I think for me there are certainly things that are not they're not meant to be read, and some things that I write, and as I'm writing, I'm thinking, you know, I write very much by sound, so I think. You know, when I find myself in a space in a poem where I kind of don't know how to get myself out, I kind of lapse into sound. I lapse into music, and that sort of resolves some of those problems. And whatever the sounds, language starts to kind of form itself around those sounds, and then I can kind of make my way out of that poem. So sometimes I am very aware that it's something that can be performed.
Frances, did you have a question you wanted to ask?
Thanks. I really appreciate your resistance to trying to talk about political poetry without having a shared definition. I think that it is hard to create a meaningful conversation about something until we all are talking about the same thing. And like Sibel, I love definitions, and I want to float one and see if it rings true for you or you have any resistance to it, which is that political poetry is a matter of scope, that when you have a very narrow scope, you're in the realm of the personal or the Robert Lowell, and then when you have a very universal scope, you might be in your Emily Dickinson non-political realm. But then there's a realm in the middle that is about the polity or looking at and reflecting on the polity, that either your local communities or your national communities or increasingly our global communities, for which we have some responsibility and or for which we're participants in some way. And if you think that this could be one definition that is potential for political poetry, that it's in that middle zone between the personal or the universal, where we're actually discussing something for which we have some representation but not all representation.
I do like what you said about scope, that does bring another dimension to it. And representation, too, seems to have something to do with politics. I like that definition. I'll take it, but I'm not... For me, the problem comes in with the personal and the political, and I guess I'm hearkening back to the old feminist saying the personal is political. So I'm wondering if a Sexton poem is not political because it's personal, but it's political in that sense that women's interior lives or sexuality of women has been marginalized and not thought of as being, you know, place for public, you know, discourse. So then when it's put there, that becomes political. So... You know, I think it can work, that scope can go back and forth between the personal and the universal, and maybe context, too, becomes a part of what makes it political.
I agree.
And I don't know... I'd noticed you wrote down Paul Celan in your notes as maybe a way to think about somebody who, at least for me, is, I guess if I would classify him as a political poet in a lot of ways, as well as a million other things, but and also as somebody whose writing has been important for me in trying to think about maybe what about poetry in general. And his poems are very personal, I mean, I would say, in the same way that Emily Dickinson's poems are very personal in a totally different way. But I gain more, I guess, political knowledge to a certain extent about from those very exquisitely personal poems than I do from anything that's more universal. And I think maybe because the very specifically personal is more universal to me, I can make sense of things when things are much more particular. In the way that they are with Paul Celan. That's a gloss. I mean, there's so much more that could be said. But.
Or to go to go to the Mary Baraka / Leroy Jones split that seems to be going on and on and on. Who was the better poet? The same guy. You know, so, and is the Leroy Jones stuff, like the, you know, the early stuff, is that not political? And is the later stuff somehow more effective as political work because it's more outwardly that just, you know, it's more, you know, about politics. So I don't know. I don't think that's been really resolved. Like, you know, does the question of aesthetics and what makes it good come into question about political poetry or not?
Question?
A comment. I also really like Robert Lowell's Notebooks. it's like so clear and natural and easy and everything, and I feel it's a lot more effective in his earlier work. Okay. I wanted to ask about Alienation, it was mentioned earlier, and there's some talk about like meaning and what you say has meaning, but the problem is when you are alienated, what you say has like no meaning whatsoever, I really was trying to figure out how to make this into a question, but I wasn't sure how. I was just curious about it. How do you like break through that problem and like actually make meaning?
That's a great question. I'm going to be thinking about that long after. And I don't pretend to have anything like an adequate answer. Disclaimer. But I think that one way to relate to alienation is depiction. It's description and detail. I can observe myself as the alienated, you know, as an alien almost. I can almost observe myself, my life, or life from the standpoint of alienation sometimes more readily than I can when I'm content. I have a harder time writing when I'm completely satisfied. When I'm completely satisfied, I'm in the world, and every breath is natural. There's not much to say when I'm completely content. I'm just being. But when there's an alien thing, it's almost as if it were other, which it's not. It's still, I don't know if that makes sense, or nonsense.
Brandon or Akila, would you like to address the topic also, or no? Okay.
I have the beginning of a thought.
Okay.
It's a really important question for me, and it's something that I think can only be resolved in writing. And the thing that I think about specifically is, I also write a lot about my grandfather, who was an enemy alien during World War II, and just to use the very essence of that word. And he was Japanese. He was put into a federal prison after Pearl Harbor, and so he was classified as an alien, and he dealt with that in ways that I'm still trying to understand throughout his life. He wasn't able to be a citizen. Came to the States in 1919. He didn't become a citizen until 1955, not because he didn't want to, just wasn't able to. And a lot of what I write about is just trying to understanding that, and understanding the ways in which his voice was not able to carry through. When he was in the prison, he was subjected to a variety of hearings at which the interpreters were Korean men who didn't speak, who didn't understand Japanese or English very well at all. So his voice meant nothing, absolutely nothing. And he was a photographer. So he converted all of that energy, I think, into his vision, and able to create some kind of life and some kind of voice through visual means.
But there are still a lot of things that I'm still trying to figure out about his post-war life and how he chose to live it. He became very Americanized as a way to avoid further persecution. And he raised his three children as the model Americans, his three Japanese children as Americans. And so he kind of, he had to, I suppose, out of a certain necessity, but it's something I struggle with. And that, for me, again, is something that only can be resolved, if at all, just by continuing to think about it and thinking about it in the writing itself. So,
we are out of time, but I want to thank you for your insights and for the conversation and for your work and for the wonderful reading. And thank you all for joining us and your great questions.